But as we've seen from the pilot and the discussion that I had about some of the other literature and experience as a coach, if we push through it and we understand that is part of the process, oftentimes we will see a favorable outcome. It's just about understanding the athlete. It's about understanding the adaptation. It's about understanding the time course to peak. And if we can do that as a coach, we're absolutely loving life.
Hi, Lee. Welcome in Evidence Strong Show. It's my pleasure to have you. Could you please briefly introduce yourself?
Thanks, Alex. So my name's Lee Bell. I'm a senior lecturer in sports and exercise science at Sheffield Hallam University. That's based in England in the UK. From a research and teaching perspective, I think to summarize my interest, it would be in strength sports programming and specifically periodization, programming strategies and tactics. But the majority of my research has been in either overtraining in strength sports or in kind of deloading and tapering, also in strength sports.
Amazing. Okay, we'll be talking about the paper that is titled Effects of a 5-Day Back Squat Overreaching Protocol on Strength Performance, Perceived Recovery, and Wellness Responses. And that's a pilot trial. So let's start with some definitions. What overreaching is?
I think for definitions like this, there are two ways to tackle it. There's either a very simple one. If we look at overtraining first, I think that's an easier route into overreaching. Overtraining can be used as a verb and it can be used as a noun. And in research, we see that that's the case, but also with practitioners, we see that's the case as well. So as a verb, as a doing word, overtraining is simply just doing more than what we can recover from. So that could be intentional. That could be a programming tactic. That might be a training camp, or it might be an impact microcycle where we choose to ramp up the frequency of training. And that could be in general, or it could be for a specific lift that we think is lagging or needs a little bit more work. It could be for a specific adaptation that we want to induce, typically something strength related, perhaps hypertrophy related. But it might also be accidental as well. It might be a miscalculation of how we're monitoring our training load relative to our recovery tactics. But in short, effectively, it's just about ramping training up relative to recovery capacity. As a noun, as an outcome, overtraining is used colloquially often to mean like the overtraining syndrome. And so here, to be properly defined by expert consensus, the overtraining syndrome is where we see a significant, that's kind of a vague word really, because it's relative to how we're measuring it, the outcome measure, but performance decrement for a minimum of 4 weeks. And that's really, really important because if we're seeing our athlete recovers back to baseline, so there's an assumption there that we've got a baseline measurement, if they recover within 4 weeks, they by definition have not had the overtraining syndrome. If we see that recovery is lagging and we see that performance hasn't returned to baseline within that 4-week period, then that's when we might investigate clinically whether this person has the overtraining syndrome. So, you know, much like any other medical condition, we can't self-diagnose. We need to be sent, we need to be referred out to a medical practitioner to go through a series of checkpoints to then properly diagnose the overtraining syndrome. So where the problem exists then is right in the middle. I said colloquially, people often call the overtraining syndrome overtraining. So now we're using one word, which is both process and outcome. And again, you know, we see that in conversations with coaches. Absolutely fine. A lot of my research is in the language that coaches use. I have no issues with that whatsoever. But the origins of the research, which are meant to be benchmarks to properly define that term, they use the same colloquial term as well. And we see that in quite a lot of even recent research, where they'll use the term overtraining and not the overtraining syndrome to mean the outcome. And sometimes the overtraining syndrome to mean the process. Now, if we were to go to that hashtag overtraining and we were to look at the first maybe 100 posts, they would always talk about overtraining as being a bad thing. But remember, it's an intentional tactic. It's an impact microcycle. It's often coaches might call it a red week if they're using a red, amber, green rating. It's a training camp. So if that was always going to arrive at a negative outcome, we wouldn't do that as coaches. So overtraining can be a positive thing if we use it appropriately. And we know, perhaps from my pilot trial, which we'll talk about later, we know from some of the other research that for certain adaptations, if we ramp up the stimulus and then we recover, we can see an improvement in performance or in that specific adaptation. So it is an intentional tactic which can be favorable. And we never really see that in the literature. We never really hear it in discussions that overtraining can be a good thing if we use it properly. So that's our first term kind of defined. Then what we come to is we arrive at overreaching. Similar sort of thing. We've got a process definition. We've got an outcome definition. We have got an expert consensus definition, but that mostly is around the outcome. So overreaching is where we see a decrease in performance that lasts fewer than 4 weeks. So between kind of 1 and 4 weeks. So we see a little bit of dip in performance. If we return back to baseline within 4 weeks, our athlete was, quote unquote, overreached. So again, what we're seeing here is that perhaps not necessarily a positive outcome. But then, to make it more complicated, we need to divide that term up into functional overreaching and non-functional overreaching. So non-functional overreaching is effectively what I've just said there, is we're not seeing any positive outcome. There was no real reason to undertake that training. We've returned back to baseline simply because it's taken us so long to recover that we've perhaps lost that potential stimulus and adaptation. Functional overreaching is where we've seen improvement in performance relative to baseline. So that's our like best case outcome. We've undertaken a really short and intense period of training. The athlete's probably not like that, and probably not like the coach for prescribing them that level of that intense exercise. We've then applied some recovery, but they've come out of the other side flying. They're stronger, they're faster, they can jump higher. Perhaps they're more muscular, depending on the type of training. But this functional overreaching is the best case, its most favorable outcome. Now, being extremely pedantic, how do we separate functional overreaching from a normal response to training? And in the literature, that is that we must, and this is very, very clear, we must see that initial decrement in performance for around a week before we see this rebound, or we might call it a super compensation effect. If we're not seeing that, then we might just label it kind of like a progressive overload, fitness to fatigue kind of response. The last part of the definition then comes down to the actual process of overreaching. Again, all that is it's just synonymous with overtraining. We often call an overreach like an impact microcycle again. So, you know, overtraining as a verb and overreaching as a verb are effectively the same thing. An overreach is just the type of intentional overtraining. We end up with these kind of myriad of different things that we can move around depending on the context of whether it's intentional, accidental, process-driven, outcome-driven. But it's really important that for us as coaches and practitioners that we understand those words, particularly if we choose to listen to podcasts like this or read articles or read research papers, because the context of the words are really, really important. And again, whilst that might seem quite pedantic, for me, that understanding the words we use in sports science is key.
Let me mirror to you what I've learned and let's see what I'm missing.
Yeah.
So in normal training, we want to apply some stimulus and hopefully it will drain the athlete so they can adapt. Now, yeah. Overreaching requires that this dip under before the adaptation has to be for a week, and then they either recover and we achieve super compensation adaptation and they get better, and that's functional overreaching, or they just go to the baseline and plateau there, and we call it non-functional overreaching because the function was to get them better. We didn't do that. So that's how I understand non-functional. If it goes for, so let's say they plateaued at 3 weeks and they stay there, and we are week four, stay there, week five, or they go down and can't bring themselves up. After 4 weeks, we call it overtraining syndrome.
Yeah. But again, I use assumption quite a lot because we have to assume quite a lot with this research area, because understandably, there's very, very little work that's been done to intentionally give someone the overtraining syndrome. In research, we have ethics boards that stop things from happening that are too risky. It comes down to an argument about risk and reward, and we can talk a little bit about that with our pilot and some of the kind of, I say loopholes, it sounds very cynical, but some of the things that we had to do in order to get this study off the ground. There are very, very little, and off the top of my head, I can think of one study in particular that's used repeated time points to track the recovery process.
How to put overreaching into context of periodization? Because I can speak from Olympic weightlifting. When you prepare for a meet, you have a structure to your training. It's not linear progression. It's not at least not at some point. You can't do just linear progression for years. So there is some kind of periodization. Now, how overreaching and possibly overtraining syndrome fits into that?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right. Linear periodization models don't lend themselves very well to incorporating a planned overreach. That there could be an argument that if we were using a summated microcycle approach. So like your traditional one would be 3 weeks where the training load increases either through volume or through load on the bar, followed by a deload, then another 3 weeks fall. It doesn't have to be 3 weeks. Summated microcycles could be 5 weeks deload, 6 weeks deload. It doesn't really matter. But there are some periodization models like block periodization, for example, that give us an opportunity to go for this 7 or 14 day period, we are going to ramp things up. You will not be in a good place. You will feel under recovered. You will feel absolutely fatigued. fatigued, you will feel sore, but you need to trust the process that we're layering on the stimulus. We're creating the adaptation. It's just being masked by fatigue. But when we apply the deload period, that fatigue will dissipate really quickly, but we'll hold on to those adaptations. If we then are on platform because we're competition or we're leading into another block of training, our athlete all of a sudden goes, wow, I feel in a really good place. Like I'm just moving really, really well. The bar's moving fast. I've got a lot of load on it. Now, we did some research on this because I come from a coaching background, and the problem that I had with some of the kind of the studies where they applied an intentional overreach was I was looking and I'm going, this is just not how people train in the real world. You can't create a fictitious microcycle and then go, oh, wow, look, these people were fatigued, and then go, coaches, you should follow this, because the coaches are ahead of what the sports scientists are doing. So what I did as part of my PhD in the early years was I spoke to coaches, you know, high level, elite level, international level coaches, and said, what do you do? Like, I want to paint a picture of an intervention that I want to apply in practice, but I wanted to mirror what you would do. And I wasn't surprised by this, but there were basically a million different ways that you can apply an overreach. And it wasn't like, oh, weightlifting coaches do it this way and powerlifting coaches do it this way. It was all about the athlete. It was all about the individual response kinetics of the athlete. What do they enjoy to a degree? What do they respond well to? I mean, we all know that some athletes just respond really well to just lots of heavy load. Some respond really well to lots of volume. A small proportion respond well to lots of volume and intensity for a short period. You know, some athletes will just not turn up to the gym if they've got the middle of a cycle. Some will, you'll ask them to just calm down a little bit, you turn your back and they're off doing a max again. So there were all of these different tactics, but effectively it was, there is a skill component to sports like weightlifting and powerlifting. So where possible, reduce the number of accessory exercises and focus on the pattern. Focus on the squat pattern, focus on the bench, the deadlift. Don't completely get rid of the other stuff, but just reduce that down a touch. Increase volume within a given period of time, a week, a session, whatever it might be, by doing more sets, by increasing the load, by increasing the density, so reducing the rest period potentially. Depends on the adaptation that we're wanting to create and whether we've got another block of training coming after the overreach or we want to be on platform to then effectively be on podium. So the answer to that is there's a million different ways to do it, but there are some kind of key metrics that we want to abide by, like lots of volume, like reducing the number of exercises. We then risk monotony because the athlete's coming in and doing what they feel like the same thing over and over again. But that unfortunately is the nature of the overreach.
I think we're clear on overreaching versus overtraining syndrome. Functional and non-functional, is there anything else in terms of functional and non-functional we need to talk about before we go into the study?
There probably is, to be honest. I think going back a good few minutes, you mentioned about with functional overreaching, we'd need to see the 7-day lag in performance before we see a supercompensation effect. And something popped in my mind there. And what I was thinking was, well, what if our athlete was to supercompensate 2 or 3 days after? Technically, we can't call it a functional overreach by definition, but it's still functional in nature because that's what we want. And there is this concept called supercompensation kinetics. And what that is that we could take a bunch of athletes, a small or a large sample, we give them all the same block of training with the same relative amount of training load. So obviously, like, you know, if you can lift more than me, you would lift more than me in the block, that type of thing. And then we give everyone the same deload or taper period, and we'll see that people peak at different time points. As coaches, we know this already. Again, coaches are way ahead of the sports scientists, but we've seen this in a small number of studies, including our pilot study, where some athletes will take 14 days to reach peak strength. So they need a longer taper period before competition. So do I need to give them a different overreach? Not really, but I need to give them the overreach further away from competition. Otherwise, they're still carrying a little bit of latent fatigue into competition. We see that some, stroke most, will peak at around 7 days, but there are a very small, and this for me is really, really interesting, there are a very small number of athletes that do not need a taper at all. So they can come off an overreach or they can come off a training block and they are straight ready to peak.
Lucky busters.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. But how do we know this unless we use repeated testing and go, wow, like if you do a taper that's 8 days, you're in perfect and prime position to win that competition. But, and it gets even more complicated, the next time we try it at 8 days, they're still in the hole. They're still feeling like shit. And they're just like, I need longer. So now we've got this like intra-individual layer of variability where we need to treat everything every athlete differently when we apply an overreach and then the taper. But this kind of like, sorry, an inter-level variability and then an intra-level variability where the same athlete might require a different duration of taper depending on where they are in the competition cycle. So it becomes very, very complicated. And to me, it comes right back to you can't create, and I think when I first started my PhD, I was very naive on this. I was like, you know what I want to create here? A framework where I can give it to coaches and go follow that. And I promise you now, your athletes will be the best they ever will be in every competition. And the more I was testing, the more I was learning, I was like, yeah, like that's a stupid idea. Because we cannot remove the coach's intuition from this.
So how do we measure?
Again, it becomes problematic. We often use proxy measures because they're not invasive. They don't layer on additional fatigue. They're quick and they're simple. The problem is sometimes we can rely on those a little bit too much. Or certainly we will rely on one singular metric. So with our pilot study, for example, what we found was that, you know, we were training people every day and we were training them hard. They were able to retain maximal strength quite well, but their jumping ability was, it just tanked. It absolutely tanked. Some of the perceptual measures, which are really, really important. Again, I don't think we can treat an athlete like a number. I think we need to get them involved in the process. But we also need to be aware that what they report, how they feel, and the objective measures sometimes don't measure up very, very well. So, you know, we had athletes some days coming in. I'm segueing into the pilot study a little bit now, but we had some athletes coming in and they were going, oh, wow, like, I just can't move today. I feel so sore. We would go, okay, well, I'll tell you what, let's see how you're jumping today. Oh, yeah, you're not jumping very well. Like, your jump has decreased by, you know, a large amount. We get them under the bar. We track the velocity of their warm-up and that's moving much slower. And we're like, this is not looking good for you. And then we go, okay, well, let's get some load on the bar and see how well the heavy load moves. No, it's moved the same. It's moved the same velocity with the same load. So we can use some of the proxy measures, but we can't dismiss what's happening right up at the top end as well. And again, and same with the previous interview, it's an issue that we have, and we sometimes just need to marry up the objective data. We triangulate it, the objective data, with how the athlete feels, but our experience as a coach as well, and go, look, yeah, we need a down day today. We need a deload day. Let's just have a more of a relaxing session, lightweight, bit of skill work. Come in tomorrow, we'll hit it again. Or we go, you know what? You're in an impact cycle. You will feel sore. Do I care that your jumps are down? Not really, because what I'm chasing is maximal strength. Get under the bar, stop complaining, and lift. Now, you can do that with some athletes, so they'll go, yeah, come on, let's do it. You're with other athletes, and you've lost that trust with them. So whilst we're triangulating the metrics, we can't dilute the coach-athlete relationship as well. Again, that's very individualistic. So I think to kind of sum up like the question, yes, there are different time courses to different adaptations in the same way that there are different time courses to chase those adaptations. Yeah. And I think that pretty much covers that really is it's important about what we choose to measure and when we choose to measure it and how we use it as a proxy.
All right. So I think it's a good moment to bring up your study and go through from the beginning how you set it up.
But what we ended up with was effectively a very challenging protocol. And I want to be very, very clear on this, that whilst the results of the study showed that I think everyone improved their one rep max, this is not a cycle that I would ever tell a coach to introduce within a training plan. Bear with me on this while I tour through it, please. So it was five successive days of back squats. We weren't allowed to do more than 5 days. Each day, the athletes used 80% of their daily max. So a daily max isn't the same load across the 5 days. We had to use quite an elaborate velocity tracking approach to go, okay, well, how, when you're fresh on day one, how fast are you moving 80% of your one rep max? So we tested them beforehand. What's your max? We had some very, very strong people on the study. Now let's look at how quick you can move 80%. You can move that at 0.75 meters per second, right? That's the load you'll use on day one. Day two, what's the load that you are still moving at 0.75 meters per second? So we're looking at daily fluctuations in fatigue. We did that not to be, you know, sports sciencey per se, but to be cruel, to stop athletes from going, oh, today that's not 80%. That feels more like a 90% and I can only do sets of two, you know? So we were basically engineering a way for people to lift repeatedly heavy loads with lots of volume.
Your protocol was designed to challenge the athletes. So you ask them to come 5 days a week at 80%. You measure velocity on the first day and then this velocity was the mark for 80% weight for each consecutive day, and they were lifting to failure.
To failure, and they did 5 sets each day. So you can look at that 2 different ways, and you could say, well, that's only 25 sets across a 5-day period. It's not a lot. But what you need to bear in mind is that that's the same lift with no variation. And we know this from when we train to failure, we are much more likely to induce a fatigue effect, potentially soreness. So what we found was that, firstly, that the load on the bar varied each day, right? As you would expect, but didn't necessarily get lower. There wasn't a pattern as such. But what we found was that day 3 was the worst day for most participants. Day 3, they came in, and I think you can attach various hypotheses to this, but in my mind, what we've got is they come in on day 2, how sore do you feel? And we did ask them this question. I feel quite sore, actually, like I did 5 sets to failure with a heavy load on the bar. Okay. Then they come in on day 3. You've got the effects of day 1 still bubbling along in the background, but now you've got the additional stimulus of day 2. So people were coming in day 3 and they were not in a nice place whatsoever. We even had one participant that's just said, like, I'm going to get through this, because it's like sunk cost fallacy. I'm like, on day 3, like, I might as well just work through it. But he was just like, just don't talk to me. Please don't talk to me. Like, just let me get on with it, because I just psychologically, I'm not in a great place.
Mental breakdown.
Yeah, exactly. And so, like, For me as a coach, that's there where I'd take him to one side and we'd have a discussion about, look, this is normal, but you need to trust the process that when we deload, when we tip, whatever it might be, you'll feel great. But in a controlled environment as a sports scientist, I'm not allowed to lead the participants. So I was just kind of like, okay, that's fine. Anyway, get under the bar, let's lift. We even had one participant peaked the load on the bar on day 5. Now, I have no hypothesis for that whatsoever, because that shouldn't happen based around everything we know around models of general adaptation, fitness fatigue, 2-factor model, whatever it might be. But this guy had a decent increase in load on the bar on day 5. Now, he actually lost his adaptation 7 days later. So that's an example there of someone where we might, and again, I'm not saying we do this in practice whatsoever, but we might start to look at that athlete as having minimal taper period, because it may well be that they respond to previous days of reasonably heavy load that somehow has a potentiating effect on their performance. So that could be an example of where we don't have a long taper, because clearly they lost that adaptation if it's a strength-based competition. In order to track what was happening from day to day, we ask questions like, how sore do you feel? How stressed do you feel? How recovered do you feel? The responses were just all over the place. Like, there was just no pattern whatsoever. And I think that harks back to this really individual response that athletes have. We looked at jumps beforehand. Jumps were just getting worse every day for most people. So that appeared to be the most sensitive to fatigue. But we can't then go, oh, your jump has decreased by X amount, we need to just take you off the study, because all of the participants did experience an improvement in maximal strength after the taper. We looked at isometric mid-thigh pull, because there seems to be a lot of discussion around how we might utilize that to track fatigue. Most people got better each day. So it seemed that the back squat protocol was potentiating the mid-thigh pull. But we know from previous literature that mid-thigh pull, the isometric mid-thigh pull and back squat performance are not correlated very well whatsoever. So there could have been a bit of a fallacy, a little bit of a mistake where we went, oh, wow, these are really clearly correlated. They're not. We had discussions around whether we wanted to do an isometric squat beforehand, but this is an example about when we read a study, we only see the outcome. We don't see what discussions and problems were encountered along the way. And one of the issues that we found was that some participants were experiencing a lot of DOMS in their traps because they've got a heavy load on their back repeatedly. So yeah, we care about how sore are their quads. We care about how sore is their lower back. But most athletes were saying, it's my traps that are really, really sore. So now you're going, okay, well, I want you to do an isometric squat. I want you to push against this bar with your traps as hard as possible. It's not going to happen. And all that's going to happen there is you risk athletes from dropping out of the study. So the decision we made was not, we feel the isometric mid-thigh pull is the best test to monitor fatigue. It's the best that we've got with the logistical issues removed. And that to me was a big, because the study was potentially so risky, that to me was, how do we remove risk as much as possible? Now, we had no participants drop out. Unsurprisingly, we had a small number of participants opt in. And I'm using the word athlete quite a lot. None of them were competitive athletes. For me, the biggest risk factor was this might affect your competitive season. Like, we might put you in such a bad state that you have to drop out from all competitions within that competition period. So anyone that was a competitive athlete, I went, you're not coming on the study. So I'm using the term athlete loosely, but they were well-trained individuals. So the average back squat, one rep max, was double body weight. And I think that that's reasonably strong. So that was the protocol. The conclusion, the end point was, back to what I said earlier about, there had only really been one study before this one that had looked at tracking maximal strength across a period of time. So I said, okay, well, what we're going to do is we're going to measure them 7 days after the protocol. We gave them like a stock taper program. It was just a very basic step taper. You can go back to normal training, but you've got to follow this exercise selection and these kind of like loading parameters to standardize it. Every single participant had improved one rep max at 7 days. And I can't say significantly because we didn't use inferential statistics because it was a pilot study. And there are big problems by using inferential stats when you've got small sample sizes. We had, I think it was 10, 8 participants. So we just reported descriptive characteristics, but we use smallest worthwhile change to say, actually, from a coach's perspective, is this practically meaningful? Every single participant had improved their one rep max to a meaningful level. So we go, okay, that's functional overreaching. But really, we can't call it functional overreaching because we didn't test them immediately post and at 7 days, so we didn't experience the lag effect. I don't care. If I'm being honest, at this point, I don't care what labels we attach to it. They got better. As a coach, that's all I care about. We then tested them at 14 days, so another 7 days afterwards. Most participants experienced another increase in strength. It didn't surpass the smallest worthwhile change, but it's still important in my eyes if an athlete's adding on an extra 2 or 3 kilos on the bar. If they're a powerlifter, for example, 2 or 3 kilos might be the difference between finishing first and finishing fourth, potentially. Some participants have returned back to baseline, so they'd not been able to retain that strength adaptation. Now, I think of it like this. What if I'd not tested them at 7 days and tested them at 14 days? Those participants that are returned back to baseline, we could say they're non-functionally overreached because we've not seen an improvement in performance. But because we tested them at 7 days, we did see an improvement in performance. They just couldn't retain it for much longer. So they functionally overreached, but then they lost it again. So it comes back to this kind of like really individual super compensation kinetics effect. That to me is where my research will go next, is why? Why does that happen? Why do some people experience a large magnitude of performance increase and can retain it for a while, whereas others will just decrease back? Why do others not experience an increase? Why is one participant, after 5 days of heavy back squats, only seen a 2 kilo increase in one rep max? And then you go, was it worth it? Probably not. But for those participants that experienced 10 kilos on the bar, that's huge. But why did they lose it 7 days later? What could we do to either retain it if we feel we need to retain it? Maybe they've got a couple of competitions in quick succession. Or how do we then go, right, what do we do with your deload or your taper? I'm using those words specifically because a taper would be leading up to competition. The deload would be leading into another block of training. How do we now engineer your training where we don't just focus on the overreach, but we focus on the relationship between the overreach and the deload or taper? So whilst we could look at this study and go, well, you didn't use inferential statistics and you had a small sample size, I tell you, please, please, if anyone wants to question that, they can come on board and be my head of recruitment. Because we recruited for a year and participants were just going, oh, I'd like to take part in the study. Tell me more. No, I don't want to. Why would they? Why would they?
Going to failure. And then...
Yeah. We had a very specific personality of participants wanted to do this study.
Did you have any females participating?
We didn't. But to be honest, that was intentional. And the reason why it was intentional was because the whole study was a 4-week period. So what I was conscious of was that then we would have to start each female at the same point of their menstrual cycle. That can be totally problematic. So I, in my other research world, do research on the menstrual cycle with female athletes, and I hated that I needed to dismiss females from this study. We have actually got, we've finished collecting data now. We've got a similar-ish study where we included females as well. But for this pilot study, we wanted to try and remove as many unnecessary working parts as possible. As I say that by now, sounds absolutely awful. But it's the reality of a controlled environment study. Males are very, very simple. Testosterone is just going like this over a period of time. But because we didn't do this in the end, but the original study was going to be using blood markers as well, it was going to be very, very problematic to have females on and go, we need to now find a reliable reliable way to track where you are in your cycle, standardize it, knowing that cycles are not standardized between athletes and with the same athlete over a period of cycles in itself, it was just easier for us to go, let's just use the guys for this study. But then, like a pilot study should do, look at the results and go, does this need refining before we then apply it in a randomized control trial fashion? That will eventually at some point be the next stage of this. But I think that the pilot achieved what it wanted to achieve.
I have a question on the smallest worthwhile difference. How did you go about that?
The calculation for that is actually really simple. It's 0.2 multiplied by the standard deviation score for the sample.
Okay.
There's no clever statistics or anything like that. It's something that coaches are using more and more now to identify with different outcome measures what is practically meaningful. Now, the more data we've got, the better that calculation will be because it's effectively working on the standard deviation. But we had quite a heterogeneous pool of participants. Our inclusion criteria was quite robust. So, for example, you couldn't come on the study unless you could score 1.5 times your own body mass. That was like the minimum threshold. There was a minimum number of years you must have trained. And so we had, although it was a small sample, almost hesitant to say clones, but very, very similar people. And there are a lot of really good videos on YouTube about how to calculate small if worthwhile change for coaches. And we use that for setting targets for athletes as well. So we've tracked you as an individual athlete across a period of time for us to see a meaningful improvement. So not just like a daily fluctuation or measurement error. We need you to improve this particular metric, jump, pull, push, by X percent or by X kilos. We calculated our smallest worthwhile change at 6 kilos. So if our athletes at 7 days were to improve their one rep max by 6 kilos, that's the smallest worthwhile change. But we can also do it on a group level as well. So you can do it by individual level athlete, or you can do it by group level athlete as well.
So did you say all the athletes crossed this threshold?
At 7 days, yeah. Every athlete had, I beg your pardon, all but one. There was that one athlete that only got a 2.
Oh, right. Day 5.
But see, this is really interesting though, because we've got some athletes that had increased by 10 kilos. I think 12 kilos was the greatest increase, I think. The athlete that increased by 2 kilos was absolutely delighted. And you kind of just go, yeah, but that wasn't practically meaningful. But this was an athlete that had competed in weightlifting at a reasonably high level, was a very, very strong guy, and had been trying to improve his bike squat for months and months and months, and it just wasn't happening. That 2 kilo increase for him was just mind-blowing. I've never seen someone so happy. I didn't want to crush him by going, yeah, that's only 2 kilos. Who am I to do that? But then the other athletes that were improving by 10 kilos, you go, mate, you've got 10 kilos on the bar. And I'm like, yeah, cool. I'm happy with that. So it's like, there's just such a disconnect between, again, this metric of smallest worthwhile change, but then the athlete is an actual human being and their background is a strength trainee as well. Yes, we need to be data-driven to understand what's happening, but as a coach, we don't rely wholeheartedly on one data point to dictate what we do. I think you raised an important point there about if we were to add 2 kilos on one of the 3 lifts in powerlifting. One of the reasons why I'm saying we wouldn't follow this protocol in the real world is because we removed all training from the program other than the back squat, because we wanted to make it as monotonous as possible, but also to remove peripheral things that we couldn't control. So for example, you know, we've got 10 athletes and 5 of them but only doing my protocol, and then 5 of them are going to the gym in the evening and training arms or, you know, bench pressing. That's still additional training load that we would need to factor in. So for us, in that controlled environment, it was easy to just go, please don't train. And again, that is one of the issues when you recruit high-level athletes for training studies, is you're telling them to stop doing what they do every day. I want you to come and I want you to take part in this study. We've no guaranteed outcome of getting better. Might even get worse, but you got to stop your normal training. And they go, well, I can't do that because I've got competition coming up in a few months' time. Why would I do that for you? So as a sports scientist, we ask a lot from high-level athletes. And that's why when you look at most studies that are using competitive athletes, they're observational. So for me as a sports scientist, I go in and I watch what's happening. and I record some of the results, not me going in to an Olympic level athlete and going, I just kind of want to fuck about and find out. Because the athlete and the coach will go, why would you do that? If I win a gold medal, that will change my life. The sponsorship money alone will change my life. Why would I do your study that will potentially ruin my season or even career? And this is the problem that we have in some of the higher level kind of studies in terms of recruitment.
I agree. Would you bring it together in some kind of conclusions for coaches, what they could and should take from the study?
I think there's a level of pragmatism that coaches can utilize from the findings of my research in its total, not necessarily the pilot. The reason why I said pragmatic is I think now there is a lot of stigma attached to this big term overtraining, and we can unnecessarily worry about it. And I feel like I'm almost being condescending because, again, I've already mentioned a few times, coaches were already doing this, but just because an athlete is reporting that they're fatigued and that they feel sore or that maybe they're bored with the training program doesn't mean that we automatically have to stop and pivot and deload. If they are in a training block where we have a window of opportunity, we might not get many across the season, a window of opportunity to layer on as much stimulus as possible. The unfortunate reality of that is you will feel tired, you will feel sore, but we know this from practitioner experience. And we know there's actually some really cool research out there from, in particular, someone that I'm doing some work with now, Kechi Anyadeki Danes, has done a lot about how the coach can steer the adaptations. And you go, well, how? How do they do that? And it's the relationship between the coach and the athlete. So let's say that I'm working with two athletes. I'm really paraphrasing Kechi's research here, but with one athlete, I go, we're going to do a 2-week block and you're going to be doing a lot of volume. You're going to be doing a lot of high intensity work. You are going to feel sore and you're not going to find this experience pleasant. I know, based on my knowledge of physiology, of strength and conditioning, of having done this before with other athletes, that when we get to the end of it and we ramp everything down, you will be cruising. You will absolutely fly. You need to have that trust in me, right? Then we've got another athlete and we go, I'm going to try this 14-day block. It's going to be tough. I saw it on the internet and I have no idea what's going to happen. You might get injured. Anyway, let's do it, right? Who do you think is going to get better? Who do you think's got more chance of positively adapting? It's going to be the first athlete. We've got trust. They know the process. There's not unnecessary stress about, oh, what's happening? Am I going to get injured? Am I going to get hurt? So hashtag overtraining on Instagram. It says I'm going to be broken. And we as a coach have a very powerful position of steering the adaptations. Now, that doesn't mean that we can give someone a really bad program and go, this will still be favorable and they'll get better. We still need to obviously use a common sense approach. But for me, it all comes down to the coach is one of, if not the most important players in this whole game. One, because they prescribe the training, but two, because they can control the relationship with, and it's reciprocal, but they can leverage the relationship with the athlete to at least give them an understanding of why they are doing an impact cycle.
And also when athlete is involved, they apply themselves differently to the plan. So if you want this hard stimulus to be applied, they actually have to do the work. So they have to give their best to pull it to be impactful.
Absolutely correct. Like, I'm a big fan of a constraints-led approach to programming. And what I mean by that is that I try to get the athlete as involved as possible in the programming, organizing the building blocks of the program.
What would be your key message for coaches?
I think, in all honesty, I probably answered that in the sense of being pragmatic. So understanding that, you know, within context of where we are within the training program, the reality is that some athletes will be tired and they will be sore at some point if we are to induce an effect, an adaptation. Sometimes we can immediately worry about that and we scale training back. But as we've seen from the pilot and the discussion that I had about some of the other literature and experience as a coach, is that if we push through it and we understand that is part of the process, oftentimes we will see a favorable outcome. It's just about understanding the athlete. It's about understanding the adaptation. It's about understanding the time course to peak. And if we can do that as a coach, we're absolutely loving life.
All right. Two short questions to finish. The first one is, what is your favorite lift?
Favorite lift? As an S&C coach, I probably feel semi-pressured to say the back squat, because we know that the back squat has got the most transferability to performance. And we can do the most with it. We can load it in different ways. We can use different velocities and we can chase all number of outcomes, from jumping to being able to run faster, to being stronger, to gaining muscle mass. But I'll be honest, right? I'm going to go with preacher curl, because I just don't think there's any shame in training arms. And I'm not going to justify any more than that. That's what I'm going to go with.
I respect that. It's accepted. All right. Where are people people can find you online if they want to follow your work or even contact you or ask a question?
Probably Instagram. So my handle is Lee, so LEE3ELL. I'm not very active on social media. I tend to share, if I get a study published, I'll share something on there. But it's probably where I have most conversations in kind of like direct private messages with coaches and with people in general. So I anyone is welcome to drop me a message and I'll always respond given time. Other than that, you know, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on ResearchGate. Similarly, I don't tend to post a great deal, but I'm always contactable.
Awesome. Thank you so much for today.
My pleasure. Thank you.